welcome to Terra Nullius Cyprus. I'm Costa Constanti. I'm coming to you today from Bondi in Sydney. It's the second time I'm having a podcast recording with someone in Bondi with Cypriot links, which is quite a coincidence and serendipitous. I'm thankful to our sponsors, CVAR, the Centre of Visual Arts and Research Severities Foundation, and Limoncello. A shout out to everyone in Cyprus. And today I am here with Professor Maria Cavallaris here in Bondi, Sydney. Welcome to the podcast, Mariamu.
Thanks, Costas. It's great to be here.
Now, I met you about a year or so ago in Cyprus, if I'm not mistaken. And you had been invited to Cyprus to receive a Republic of Cyprus President's Medal. Tell me a little bit about that. It wasn't for bungee jumping. It wasn't for anything athletic. It was for something much more important.
Well, Costas, I received the medal for my contributions to medical research, particularly for my research in cancer, where I focus on children's cancer. Mm-hmm. So I do research trying to understand what causes children's cancers, how to better treat children's cancer as well.
I don't think there's a person alive that wouldn't appreciate the work that you do. First of all, cancer is something that affects far too many people around the planet. And certainly children's cancers are something that affect far too many children and certainly the families and parents and what and siblings of children that have cancer. Now, my understanding is that children's cancer is a sector of cancer that's not as well researched and as popular in the funding streams and whatnot, which is, for me as a father of three, incomprehensible. What would you say is the reason for that? Is it just not a moneymaker, or it's just not cool enough? What would the reason be for that?
It's been a number of, reasons. I think first and foremost, just to say a little bit, because your listeners may not know about children's cancer, that it is the most common cause of disease-related death in developed countries. So,
Children or in general?
For children. So in a country like Australia, it's the most common cause of disease-related death in children. But relative to adult cancer, it's relatively rare. Okay? So now children get very different cancers to adults. And that's why we need very specific research for children with cancer, because their disease is different. It's not identical. It's not that some drugs can't be used in adult cancers and children's cancers, but really we need research around specific treatments for children's cancer.
Why is children's cancer so different? Is it because they are smaller? Is it because their cells are younger?
The biology. It's really about the biology of the tumours. So where adults, many of their cancers are associated with mutations in genes that they've acquired as they've gotten older, then in children it's often different sort of genetic changes that occur rather than mutations. Okay. So what drives their cancers, like the how the genes drive the cancers, the environment these cancers are growing in, is very different to adult cancer. So that's one thing. You also touched on the fact that it's also more complex in children because they're different sizes. So, for example, treating an infant is different to treating a toddler to treating, young teenager, because their body's makeup, their sizes, how their body will respond to therapy can be quite different. So it's complex in terms of how you treat these kids.
Is it also a case of, would I be right to say that children are more sensitive to therapies? It can knock them about a bit more than it would an adult. Like, could an adult take a therapy stronger than a child?
Actually, in many cases, it's the opposite.
Okay.
Surprisingly, children can tolerate some of these treatments at higher doses than adults. And I'm talking more general here, okay? Yeah. There's a lot of therapies, there's a lot of new therapies. But for the standard chemotherapy, there's often the children can tolerate it. But again, it depends on the age you're talking about here. And, there's various reasons in terms of why that happens. And, we don't fully understand it. Mm-hmm. But yes, they can tolerate it. So they're pretty amazing children. You know, they can get very sick from their treatment,
yeah.
yet sort of bounce back sometimes, you know, quite easily.
Do you find that children mentally are better prepared or better respond? They respond better to therapies than adults do, who maybe are more understanding of what's happening?
Look, again, it's so variable with age. Yeah. You know, say a child, you know, under five, will, you know, a lot of it's about the immediacy of what's happening to them, and and when they're not having treatment, they're not having needles put in, you know, they will just get on and play and things because they don't have a concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an older child that's say, you know, say over eight or you know, close mm-hmm. to 10 and young adolescent, you know, they're much more aware of other factors that impact them. So, again, I think one of the – look, at every different age, there's different issues that have to be faced on how they mm-hmm. Deal with things. It's very tough on adolescents
yeah.
Because, you know, that's a stage where their bodies are changing, you know, they're becoming out with their friends, with their they're going out with their friends, there's image issues, mm-hmm. you know, things like losing your hair or being in, you know, not be able to go to events because you're immunosuppressed. Mm-hmm. You know, it impacts that, it psychologically it impacts their life. So again, it's so dependent on where they're at in their life.
What have been some major changes since you started researching and working in the industry? And from the time you first started studying, have there been any major shifts in the paradigm and in the understanding of children's cancers that you could share with us, that you are familiar with?
Yeah, look, it's been an amazing success story.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the years I've worked in children's cancer, and that's 40 years mm-hmm. that I've been working in children's cancer research, you know, we've seen survival rates when we first started working in this space, it was around, you know, 70 to 75% survival rates. We're now up to about 85% survival okay. rates for children's cancer. And for certain children's cancers, which didn't do so well, there's been major advances. So I remember when I first started a kidney cancer called Wilms tumours, you know, didn't always do so well, you know, as a kidney cancer. Well, now 95% of kids survive that cancer.
But I'm assuming just like adults, the earlier you catch it, the better, correct?
Look, generally, but it's also about, you know, how responsive. It's mm-hmm. it's always better to try and catch it early, but it's not like you can screen children with cancer because it is a relative rare disease. So unless there's a genetic predisposition in the family,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't be screening routinely sure. for a cancer.
Well, look, on that note, when you mentioned family, just like there's the predisposition in a certain family of certain cancers, certain communities, certain ethnic groups have certain cancers, if I understand correctly, that run through them. In a country like Australia, the United States, Canada, we have multicultural societies where not everyone is Greek or Indian or Turkish or German. How does that affect diagnosis and understanding of cancers? Because let's use Cyprus as an example. We're familiar in Cyprus with thalassemia. Okay, it's not a cancer, but use that as an example. So we know everyone gets tested for thalassemia, if they're a carrier or whatnot, before they have children. But you wouldn't do that here in Australia, for example. The Cypriot community that's aware of it may do so, but a doctor's not generally going to look at a Cypriot and say, hey, you're about to have kids, let's do a thalassemia test. Is it similar to that with cancer? Like, I mean, you have a vast array of the world's ethnicities visible and present in Australia. That must affect cancer diagnosis and understanding of preventative checking.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about mm-hmm. predominantly, Costa,
mm-hmm.
is predominantly adult cancers.
Okay.
So that there's genetic predispositions in that way. I mean, okay. we do know that there's a small percentage, there's a percentage of, children's cancer that is associated with genetic predisposition, mm-hmm. but we're only just really understanding that a lot more now.
Okay.
But it's not it's not like it's so common that you would, you know, or we understand it enough that we would do it. So there's a particular gene that's involved in the repair of DNA damage, and the DNA is part of our genetic makeup, and our cells are geared up to repair damage as it happens, because we all get damage every single day on our DNA.
Yeah.
But our body deals with it by going in and repairing it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this very, very rare condition, and it, you know, familial condition, that means it, you know, it runs in families, but fortunately it's rare, where people don't have that repair enzyme. It's defective. Okay. And so those families have a high incidence of cancer, and it starts in childhood. You know, by the time they're usually, you know, 20 or 30, they've got cancer, right?
Okay.
But it's a very rare condition, and those families, where it's known, are followed through and monitored very closely.
So basically everyone that's a child of this lineage would get regular tests.
And the adults in that family as well.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, we're learning more about it. We're trying to understand better, is there a way to prevent certain types of pediatric cancers, like children's cancers? But again, through what we call precision medicine, which is personalized medicine programs, where they're collecting genetic information and what we call phenotypic, where they can test the cells from the patients as well, we're starting to understand a lot more where, you know, there may be genetic predisposition. But in many cases, in over 85% of cases, or 80% of cases, there's no direct link with genetic predisposition. We don't know. There is so much to still learn about what the causes of childhood cancer are.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming that you must interact and share best practice and things that you've learned with colleagues across Australia and around the world. Now, I've seen you traveling overseas a fair bit, and I know that it's not a holiday because I know that you're working when you go on these trips. What kind of colleagues are you interacting with? Where are your main collaborations? Are they in the West? Are they in Europe? Where do you find your best collaborations?
Well, look, I'll start by, you know, I work at the Children's Cancer Institute, which is an independent medical research institute here in Sydney.
So it's non-government?
It's independent medical research institute, and it's affiliated. We're affiliated with the University of New South Wales, and one of the things our institute is internationally connected with the major children's treatment and research centres around the world, including the Children's Oncology Group in the US, the key children's groups in the UK, as well as Europe as well. And, you know, because childhood cancer, as I said at the beginning, is relatively rare compared to adult cancers, we need to share genetic information, because some of these genetic events are so rare, unless you've got a lot of samples to pull the data together, you know, you don't see these patterns emerging. So from that level, from my own research, in that situation, I do collaborate with people around the world and have connections. So I've just returned from New York, for example, where I was working, meeting with people at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, because we have a collaboration with one of our staff members, a research staff members who got a Fulbright Fellowship and is working over there for 9 months, 10 months. And so that was one example. I was in San Diego to attend the American Association for Cancer Research meeting. So this is the largest cancer research meeting in the world. There was 23,000 researchers from around the world. And it's where you go to really present your own work, but also see where research is at across the broad spectrum of cancer research, because it's very, very broad, and also speak to colleagues and establish collaborations and share knowledge.
What happened during the pandemic, all these international collaborations, the in-person stuff must have fallen by the wayside for 2+ years. Did that have a negative impact, or did it introduce innovative methods to share data and information?
There is no doubt that the pandemic impacted many of us around the world. One, because we often couldn't have our lab members in the lab. I mean, they weren't even allowed to attend. But it varied from place to place whether that happened. Yes, that personal interaction was tough. But again, you know, you don't hold up the science. So where we were able to, you know, we were doing teleconferencing and, you know, I was invited a number of times to virtual meetings and so I spoke at virtual meetings. Other people did as well. And so we did our best to keep it all together. Okay. At the peak of the pandemic, it was just difficult to even be allowed to have people in the laboratory. So many of our researchers had to work virtually or working from home. And you know, you can't work in the lab when you're working from home.
No, exactly.
So it was a challenge. Yeah, yeah. But look, but having said that, you know, we did our best to keep everything going.
You feel that the industry in general has caught up and is back to where it should be and back on track?
Oh, yeah. I think we've all been, in many ways, it also allowed you to pause and think about what you were doing and where things were at. And,
yeah, good point.
But it was, yes, look, having just, like I said, come back from the American Association for Cancer Research annual meeting, people, you know, it's thriving. There's, you know, more investment in research and cancer research. And, I mean, look, we need more. It's always a challenge because, you know, research funds, unless they're from charity organisations, are not directed just for cancer. You're competing against all different diseases, cardiovascular disease, mental health, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's through a competitive process that we need to do this.
Before we touched on innovation, now when I think of you, I think of innovation because one of the first things I learned about you was something that you created, invented. I'm not sure what the right word is. I want you to tell me a little bit about this 3D printer because I know that people listening right now are going to find this absolutely fascinating, groundbreaking, total Star Trek level stuff. So tell us a little bit more about that, Maria.
Okay, so what you're referring to, Costas, is a 3D bioprinter that I was part of the development of. So I was contacted by someone that I knew in cancer research a number of years ago who was establishing a startup company, and he had this idea about developing a 3D bioprinter. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to know from cancer researchers or other researchers, if there was a device like this, what would they use? What would they want it to do? And I was part of the initial consultation process. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he went away and about 6 months later came back and said, I really want to do this. Would you be part of the team to help develop it? And I was quite excited about this concept, and I'll explain a bit more about what it does. Mm-hmm. So I agreed to come on board because apart from my role at the Children's Cancer Institute, I also am a founding director of the Australian Centre for Nanomedicine at the University of New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And one of my co-directors, unbeknownst to me, was also approached about developing what we call the bioinks for this printer.
Bioinks. Okay, yep.
So they're not inks as in, so imagine a printer. So instead of printing, words on a page, you're actually needing to print something that can support biological life.
Okay.
And so he was creating these bioinks. My lab was doing all the biology for this. With this bioprinter, what we did is the company called Inventia Life Sciences, the biotech startup company that here in Sydney. So in my lab, we did the prototype and we were able to show that we could bioprint cells. So Costas, just to, tell you what this bioprinter is about.
Mm-hmm.
For me, what excited me when this concept of a bioprinter came about was that we would be able to print cancer cells and develop mini tumours in a dish.
Mm-hmm.
And
so basically you'll have a cancer, let's say a tumour, in a dish isolated from a human body.
Yeah.
Yep, okay.
And the idea is that we, with this being able to grow these mini tumours in a dish, but we weren't just growing the mini tumours. That's something we've been able to do for a bit in the lab. What was unique about what we were doing is we were actually the BioInk itself was designed to mimic the environment these tumor cells grow in the body.
Okay.
So imagine you make jelly, and within the jelly you've got fruit. Mm-hmm. Imagine instead of that, you know, the jelly actually, instead of having fruit in there, has got tumor cells, and it's starting, and those tumor cells can grow and expand, they metabolize, and then we can screen them for sensitivity to different drugs to identify what drugs they may be responsive to, and also drugs they're not responsive to. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking, you know, you want to identify the best treatment for a patient in a timely way,
you want to
make sure that you can identify the drugs that their tumours will respond to. But the reason you also want to identify drugs they're not going to respond to, because those drugs may be the standard of care therapy for their particular cancer.
Yeah.
But if their cancer's not going to respond to it, why expose them to drugs that may make them sick but not work, but also delay the use of effective therapies? So I was really excited about this concept that we could do this. Now, I've got to say, you know, it's a big project to start something from scratch.
Yeah.
From the whole engineering side to the development of these bioinks, making sure they were biocompatible, that means that, the, you know, when you're printing cells, that you could they were highly viable and they could survive, and you can do this. And then once we did this, we had to characterize what we were creating. That means we had to study and say, does this look, is it behaving? Does it have the features of the original tumours?
Okay.
And, you know, so we've done a lot of work now in this area, and all the initial work we did was on cancer cell lines in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really exciting now, and I should say, you know, it was such a big innovation. It's won a number of awards for the company, and for us researchers, has also won us the Australian Museum's Eureka Prize for mm-hmm. innovative use of technology. And that was really exciting to have it recognised as, you know, an innovative type technology. And
well, the implications are phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is opening up opportunities. It's a, you know, it's an important tool, but it's not just for screening for drugs. We may want to, let's just say we identify a genetic mutation in a patient, but no one knows what that genetic alteration does. Well, in the lab, we can manipulate those cells. We can introduce a genetic mutation into normal cells.
Wow.
And say, does this mutation cause the cancer? Does it just change the behavior of the cells? Is it, you know, so there's different things that these mutations do, or is it doing nothing? We don't know.
You know, it makes me think, sorry to interrupt you, but other than curing tumours, could you not use the same technology to create the tumour in the biomass, then to actually see what kind of foods or what kind of carcinogens in the environment can make it grow or whatnot, so you can then start educating people on how to, what things not to eat or whatever, like, because I mean,
so that one's a little bit tricky. Not because you can't do something like that. The carcinogens and things that may be bad for you are often accumulated mutations. So in these are not like these are shorter term studies. You can make them longer term, but they're. It's not to say you can't do something to see any short-term damage.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, for what you're saying, you can do short-term damage, but you really want to know, is it longer-term exposure?
Yeah.
It's quite rare that unless you give a very high dose of a carcinogen,
mm-hmm.
most of us are probably exposed to toxins and carcinogens at lower levels, and sometimes it's the accumulation of things.
Well, let's just scare the separate listeners for a moment. Now, my understanding is that charcoal-cooked foods
mm-hmm.
The embers and the smoke, the toxins coming off the charcoal and embedding into the grilled meats is apparently a carcinogen.
Yeah.
And I know that the EU was trying to regulate souvlaki and mangal in the north, you know, from being used as a method of food cooking. So they were trying to convince Cypriots to convert to electronic or gas cooking as opposed to charcoal cooking. Now, of course, that's just a causes belly for the Cypriots, you know. But I do wonder that if there was to be some direct evidence showing that, you know, charcoal cooking, wood fire cooking is indeed accelerating cancer chances or tumor formations or mutations, perhaps some people will at least have the knowledge and thus the option to avoid it if they wanted to. Maybe not make it a law, but so I don't know. I'm guessing you can't really do that in this kind of setting, right?
No, you won't do it in this type of setting. And look, there is evidence that, you know, that when you're barbecuing, you're that char grill, you know that if you have excessive, you know, it is a carcinogen in high amounts. This does not mean if you eat a steak that's been barbecued on charcoal or souvlaki, it's going to suddenly cause cancer. But you've got to take everything into account. So eating too much red meat, how that meat is cooked, you know, all things that can impact our health. So, you know, I always think you should do everything in moderation and balance.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you were eating souvlaki every single night,
and charcoaling it to death.
It's not good for you because you have too much red meat. And if you think about the traditional, the old traditional Mediterranean diet, particularly in Cyprus, you know, it was legumes and salads and meats were often on a Sunday.
A luxury.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you didn't eat as much meat. You know, and this is the same in many Mediterranean countries, but we're seeing a shift from that where meat consumption has increased. How you cook the meat. It's not that, you know, if you had souvlaki on a Sunday every Sunday, you know, probably your exposure is not excessive. If you eat it every day or every second day, maybe it is more excessive, but you've got to balance that with eating fresh fruit and vegetables, exercising, you know, limiting your alcohol intake because everything accumulates.
As adults and as the selfish species that we are as humans, what we learn about children's cancers and curing them and treating them and so forth, how much of that is then applicable or opens up learning for adults and the geriatric age cancers? You know, is the some of that give a segue to that?
I'm not aware of anything like that at the moment. I think what we're discovering are some of the technologies that are being developed for adult cancers or even for children's cancers and et cetera, some of the technologies that are being developed to study cancers, being able to do things like gene editing and, you know, understand how things are working. You know, the techniques we use are often similar.
Yep.
The discoveries are different, if that makes sense.
Yep, no, it does. So tell me, if we take some steps back now, how did you get into this? Why did you choose to go into children's cancer research and nanomedicine? I mean, why did you go there and you didn't become an accountant like most other Cypriots or a lawyer? What drove you that way? Is it passion for the industry?
I was always interested in science. When I was in high school, I really liked science. I loved geography as well. But I liked science and I liked art. But I decided, that I wanted to pursue a career in science. So I was quite unusual because I didn't finish high school. Okay. I left at year 10.
Wow.
And I went to do something called a pathology technician certificate. Okay. So this is a science job, so where you go in a pathology lab and you do the tests that are done in a pathology lab. So I did that for, it was a year full-time and 2 years part-time. Mm-hmm. So it basically the idea is that did 1 year full-time and then you did 2 years part-time, but during that time you're getting work experience in pathology lab. But I was by the time I was looking for my first job, I was 16, and I was the only one in my year who hadn't finished their high school certificate. And so it was incredibly difficult. I remember writing 200 letters trying to get jobs.
Yeah.
And because I was so young, I wasn't even getting a look in.
Yeah.
And then my first job that I did get was actually in a research lab at the University of Sydney. And this I was actually split between two labs, one working in hearing research, the other one in brain research.
Wow.
They were next door to each other. And that just suddenly opened up my eyes that, wow, there's all these opportunities in research and different types of careers. And
yeah.
So I actually decided then that I was going to do my undergraduate degree once I finished pathology technician certificate. And I knew even before I left school that if I finished this course, it would get me into university if I chose to go to university.
So you could do that and skip the HSC at the high school? Because I don't think you can do that anymore, can you?
No, they've changed things. So I was very fortunate.
Well, you were a bit of a Doogie Howser, weren't you?
Yeah, I know. So what I did is I finished my TAFE course, and then I enrolled part-time in a degree course, like a science degree course. In the meantime, after about 2.5 years at Sydney Uni, they were running out of research funds. This is the problem with research. They were running out of research funding, and they wanted to give me adequate warning that mm-hmm. they may not have funding to keep me on. So I also thought at that stage it was also a good idea for me to get broader experience.
Mm-hmm.
And my next job was at the University of New South Wales in a cancer research lab.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was 19 when I joined that lab, and it was very fundamental cancer research. And that was great. And I did that for, 2 years. But just after my 21st birthday, around the same time everything was happening once, the head of the lab that I was working for got offered this opportunity to be the inaugural director of mm-hmm. the Children's Cancer Institute.
Yeah.
And he offered to take his staff with him, and he asked if I would like to go with him. And two of us out of the six said, yes, we'll go. Around that same time, as I just said yes to all of that, I was also diagnosed with cancer at the age of 21.
Yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
And I actually went through, very high-dose chemotherapy, had, the toxic side effects that you see. And in those days, particularly, the therapy was actually very aggressive. Mm-hmm. Nowadays they've managed to pull it back a bit, not to be as bad, but it was pretty aggressive. And I saw, during that transition, halfway through my treatment, we started the Children's Cancer Institute. I met a lot of kids and families impacted by cancer, and I thought, I'm 21 and I know what's going on, and
it was
very
difficult.
And I'm watching,
I'm
watching these kids, and some of them, just knew that their parents were forcing them to go to hospital to feel sick, So it was, and I sort of decided then that really, I wanted to try and develop a career in cancer research. So, eventually, after over a year, I finished my treatment. It was more like a year and a half. And then I had already commenced my undergraduate degree. So the year I was turned 21, I was done my undergraduate degree. And I did that over 6 years part-time. And then as soon as I finished, I enrolled in a master's. And after 2 years, I converted it to a PhD.
Wow.
To get my PhD. Now, in the second year I was doing my PhD, I had just finished my first year, my brother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And 6 weeks later, he had died from the disease. It was so rapid. He was 30 years old, so it was unheard of. So it was so advanced.
Was it was so aggressive, or was it also because it was diagnosed quite late?
It was diagnosed late, but there was actually no treatment for pancreatic cancer. There was very few people survived. And even nowadays, after all these years, that's still a very aggressive cancer. Had nothing to do with the cancer I had. Mm-hmm. Very different. Mine was more one associated with childhood. Mm-hmm. His was more one that normally is associated with older adults. But again, he had no option. Like, I had options for treatment, as horrible as they were.
Yeah.
I had options, but, three doctors came in one after the other saying, there's nothing we can do. We can't operate. We can't give you any treatment that's going to work. And it really struck me that it's just there's so much more that needs to be done in cancer.
No, that's actually, I don't know what the right word for that is. I mean, you floored me. I mean, I knew of your brother. I didn't realize you also had had the personal experience of cancer and all that's that comes with it. And then, of course, your brother, you just had one brother?
No, we were a family of five. So I've got an elder brother, my oldest brother. That was my second brother. Mm-hmm. I'm a middle child, you know, so
Quite difficult. I know a middle child's a lot. No, I totally understand you, okay?
And then two sisters.
Okay. Now, let's go back even further in history. You were born where?
In Australia, Sydney, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, only about a 10-minute drive from here at Bondi Beach.
Okay.
In Surrey Hills.
So you haven't migrated far, but I know that you have migrated at times. So tell me a little bit about where. Yeah. So we know you're born in Sydney. At some stage, you've ended up in Cyprus.
Yeah. So my parents were born in Cyprus and then emigrated to Australia when they were in their teens.
Mm-hmm.
My parents met and were married here in Australia and had us five kids, and they decided to move us to Cyprus at the end of 1970, and we moved to Cyprus. So that was a big move. I think
that's an epic move in 1970 with five kids.
Yeah, I know. And anyway, we moved to Morpho, which is where my dad was from. And
where's your mum from?
Askas.
Askas. Okay.
Yeah, we moved to Morpho, and we lived there for just under 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, at first I went to my brother Con, who's passed away, and myself were sent to Greek school, which I've got to say we hated it. well, you know, because we didn't speak much Greek and we couldn't read, you know, read or write, you know, I was meant to go in year four, I got put in kindergarten. And then within 6 months, I'd progressed to year two. And my brother was the same. They put him like 2 or 3 years below his age.
And that was in a Greek public school in Morpho?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And my eldest brother was at the English school.
Mm-hmm. In Nicosia?
No, he was at the grammar school, actually. It was the grammar school.
So he was commuting from Morpho to the grammar school every day. Although, to be fair, the grammar school back then was on the western side of Nicosia. Yeah. So I guess from Morpho would have been a straight run. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And anyway, after about 6 months, my brother Con and I went and saw my parents and said that if they did not move us to an English school, we were running away from home.
Did it work?
So they said, okay. And we said, no, we're serious. They said, yeah, okay, you can go to an English school. And we're going, and we thought, no, that was way too easy. Anyway, little did we know, they realised we weren't happy. And and so there was a new school about to start, and it was it was like the junior school of the GC School of Careers. And after 6 months we went there. We were the inaugural students. And then we went on to the GC School of Careers where we started high school. And so I did year seven there.
And again, this is all commuting from Morpho to
Yes, it was
early. With a public bus?
Early mornings.
School bus?
I mean, from what I recall, I just remember getting up really early to get there.
Well, yeah, school starts so early in Cyprus. I mean, sometimes 7:30, you know. So you're in Morpho until the day of the war in 74?
Yes, that's right.
And then from there, what happened?
When the war broke out, initially, you know, there for a bit, and then, some planes had dropped some bombs in Morpho. So my parents moved us, the five kids and the station wagon to Askas, where my great-grandparents were.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved up to the – and luckily it was summer, that you didn't need to pack too much up there. So we stayed in the mountains, and I think we stayed there. You know, there was a couple of rounds of fighting that was going on. After about, I can't remember, there was about 4 or 5 weeks, the British, the radio kept making announcements that if you were a non-Cypriot Greek or Turkish citizen, that you could go to the English bases and get airlifted out of Cyprus. They were actually trying to get foreigners out of the
off the island
and, much to my mother, just insisted that we needed to get back home. We were Australian citizens. We had passports. My father kept saying, no, it's going to be fine. They're all going to go. They're going to get rid of them.
He had what a lot of people thought, like, oh, this is just a temporary thing. Yes. A couple of weeks' time and we'll go, but your mum must have felt.
Yeah, yes. So the day we got to the British bases, we heard on the radio that Watford had been taken over.
Yeah.
And we just got airlifted to just out of London, and then we spent 2 weeks in London with my mother's cousin, and then they pulled money together from friends in Australia and got us back to Australia, and they had to rebuild their lives again.
Literally starting from scratch once more.
Yeah, well, they did. They just built a brand new house. So we lived there for 4 weeks in this brand new house, fully furnished, all architect design. And so all their cash had been poured in there as well. It was also in the co-ops in Morfor because you had the citrus things. So literally they had to come back and start all over again.
So then you come back to Sydney, hit the refresh button. Now at some stage you yourself was as an adult, you went to America, to the US?
Yes. Yeah, so when I finished my PhD, about a year after I finished my PhD, I managed to get a really prestigious fellowship from the World Health Organization an arm of the World Health Organization called the International Agency for Research on Cancer.
Right.
And this gave me the opportunity to go and do advanced cancer research training at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York.
Wow.
And I ended up spending 2 years there, which was fantastic. And really, I learned so much about being a scientist and being an independent scientist. And when I came back to Australia, I started setting up my own laboratory and establishing my own team.
Well, we're very lucky here in Australia that you came back and didn't get headhunted by the Americans and kept
there.
Well,
I did. I did get offered a job to stay there and had to make a lifestyle decision as well.
Yeah, yeah. And plus your family was here. Yes, exactly. It helps. Okay, well, look, in closing, do you see any potential for any Australia-Cyprus research collaboration in this field? Are there cancer researchers in Cyprus, or is this?
Yes, look, there are. When I visited Cyprus when I got the presidential medal, I spoke to some researchers there. Obviously, resourcing for research is much lower in Cyprus, so it's a challenge for them to get research funds. But there's some very good researchers, particularly people who trained in the US or the UK or other European countries. So a lot of the people I spoke to were more in the epidemiological type space that doesn't require laboratory type research. But that's a rich area for people who work in that space to work in, because I think Cyprus is a very interesting genetic mix as well to better understand. Because it's really important you touched on this right at the beginning about, the different, cultural groups and ethnic groups, because, how they respond to therapy, is quite different. And a lot has been coming out in recent years about one of the big problems is that in a lot of clinical trials, they don't include women. Or they haven't included women, and how women respond to these therapies is very different to how men do. It's the same for different ethnic groups. You look at the African American population, their survival rates are nowhere near as good as the Caucasian population, and a lot of research hasn't been done in that space. So it's very important that we better understand how ethnicity and the genetics and the different ethnic groups impacts response to therapies, because really everyone should be given the same best opportunities there are for
live a human life
to live a long life.
Look, Professor Maria Cavallaris, thank you so much for the work you do. As a child of Aphrodite, as a Cypriot heritage Australian, the work you do is incredibly fascinating, incredibly important. I won't say unique, because you do have your collaborators and your international networks, but it is something that I don't think people understand and appreciate as much as they should, and I'd like them to get to know more about this. So one more time, where you're working now, if people want to look it up.
Yes, I'm at the Children's Cancer Institute, mm-hmm. Which is an Australian-based independent medical research institute in Sydney, mm-hmm. and the University of New South Wales in Sydney.
Thank you, thank you. I wish you the very best. I hope to hear more innovation, more development, more positive news, more research and discovery. And I'd like to see that 85% survival rate go up even higher. I want to see it 99.9999. I'm sure we all do. Thank you so much. And please, anyone that's listening, that's in Cyprus, working in the field or interested in working in the field, reach out to us, pop a comment on the post. And I'm sure Professor Maria would love to hear from others that are in the industry. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Costas. Oh, and by the way, we really want 100% survival.
I agree. As I said that, I thought, yeah.
Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.